Right. Well, thank you very much. I think I probably have to deny any responsibility for any of those somewhat political remarks, Michael, but thank you for starting it lively. Right. As Jean said, there is going to be some interaction here. I saw some alarmed looks from my table when they heard the word interactions. Don't worry, it's not sort of expressive dance or anything. We're not about to start break dancing here. But if you look on the screen, those of you that have used this thing called Menti before or Slido, and if you have a phone, get it out and log on, either use the QR code there or the number at the bottom left, you will see when you get through, hopefully you can, as many of you as possible, four questions. They're quite simple questions. Have a go at them if you could in the next couple of minutes. The reason I say in the next couple of minutes is because I'm going to give you some of the answers later on, so... spot some guys from school at the back. I'm sure that there are techniques here, but don't wait till I give you the answer before answering, because it will be physically possible to tell whether you've heard the right answer or not. But log on to Menti if you can and answer those four questions while I'm speaking, and then we'll come back and see what your answers were in a moment. Right, well, look, my theme today is learning and the role it plays in monetary policy making. So it's fitting that I'm speaking with you on my first visit to Brisbane, just a stone's throw from two great local seats of learning, the Queensland University of Technology and the University of Queensland. And I think at this point, this sort of various tables should go whoop whoop, because there's many of you here. There is one. Thank you. QUT's Gardens Point campus sits on a stunning peninsula in the Brisbane River that's full of history. The Botanic Gardens started life, as you will know if you work there, in 1828 as a means of feeding the penal colony. And the old government house was built in the 1860s for the first governor of Queensland, Irishman Sir George Bowen, and his wife, the tremendously titled Contessa Diamantina di Roma. But the history of the area and its connection with learning is actually much older than that. The river, or Maywar, as it was long known, has been a source of life for the Yugara and Turrbal peoples for thousands of years. And the area around Gardens Point was actually a sacred site where Aboriginal women received ceremonial teaching and men were forbidden. Today, QUT is establishing a new Faculty of Indigenous Knowledges and Culture to recognise and foster Indigenous Australian excellence and innovation. And against that rich backdrop, I also want to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders here today. Head southwest down the river to St. Lucia and the University of Queensland's Great Court and look upwards, and you'll see a carving of a jovial man in a hat, which is said to be Dr. Colin Clark, a prominent British disciple of John Maynard Keynes. Clark was recruited in the late 30s by Queensland Premier Bill Forgan-Smith, himself Glaswegian, to help make the case in Canberra for more expansionist state spending and establish one of the earliest systems of national accounts. Now, when Keynes heard that Clark was going to settle in Australia, he wasn't very pleased, and he tried to dissuade him. He wrote to him and said he was wasting his life and that he'd be more influential coming back to England. Clark told to get lost, that he was having none of it. Australia, he wrote, was too remarkable an opportunity to be missed. Its people had minds which are not closed to new truths, and the country would show the world in economics, politics, education, and technology in the next 20 years. In what seems to have been the clincher, he noted that economics ranks next only to cricket as a subject of public interest. Now, 100 years later, I changed very little in his judgment and my own early impressions of Australia, with one notable exception, which is that sport quite often plays second fiddle to economics in general, and the RBA in particular, on the front pages. Now, a vibrant public economic debate with diverse views is healthy, but one feature of the landscape I think is a bit less desirable, and that's the extraordinary certainty with which individual views about the outlook for the economy and the path of monetary policy can sometimes be expressed. The economy is falling off a cliff, you might read. No, someone else says, the economy is red hot. Rates up now, we're way behind the curve. No, rates are clearly too high, slash them. Opposing perspectives are castigated as incompetent, biased, or on the make, and changes in view are often presented as disastrous or humiliating failures. In short, it's a winner. It's a world of winners and losers, gurus and charlatans, geniuses and buffoons. And that's not unique to Australia, of course. Everyone's prone to it in some way. Witness the extraordinary calls for emergency intra-meeting rate cuts in the US just a few days ago during the recent market turbulence, for instance. An eye-catching language sells newspapers, it secures clients, draws crowds to the soapbox. But when the stakes are so high, claiming supreme confidence or certainty over what is in truth a very uncertain and ambiguous outlook is a dangerous game. At best, it needlessly weaponizes an important but difficult process of discovery. At worst, it risks driving poor analysis and decision-making that could harm the welfare of all Australians. It's right to want to be confident that the central bank will do its job to bring inflation back to target and maintain full employment. But the policy strategy required to get to that outcome and the economic judgments that inform it just can't be stated with anything like the same degree of certainty. Those pretending otherwise are false prophets. Overconfidence isn't unique to economic commentary. It's a universal human failing. And in my remarks today, I first want to illustrate some real-world examples of that before turning to ways in which central banks can avoid falling prey to it in our own deliberations. So to illustrate, let me see if this works. Yeah, there we go. Oh, those are the questions, sorry. You've all answered them, or variants of them. I'll come back in a minute. Sadly, some of the smarter bits of the questions, I wasn't clever enough with Menti to code up, but we'll get to them in a minute. So to illustrate how commonly overconfidence arises in everyday life, let me pose those four questions, most of which have a Queensland flavour. I'm keen to know your answers, but also your confidence in those answers. Now, question one provides scope for the greatest certainty, because there is a precise, knowable answer. In fact, let me just go back there, which is this one. How many paving stones cover QUT's Gardens Point campus? At the same time, it's not an easy question. Few of us have intimate knowledge of the campus, although I've spoken to a few who do, and they haven't got a clue the number either, by the way. Fewer still are quantity surveyors, and very few of us have time to go down and count them. So we're likely to give what we think of as wide ranges of uncertainty around our central guess. What's striking, though, is that although we may think those ranges we give are wide, they're actually almost always far too narrow. This table shows the results of an exercise in which professionals across a wide range of different industries there down the left were asked a set of hard but factual questions, just like the one about the paving stones. And the columns on the right show how often people's ranges of uncertainty around that central estimate were too narrow to include the true answer. So, for example, only 10% of those asked to give 90% confidence intervals should miss the true answer. But in fact, those miss rates lie between 42 and 64%. People are vastly too confident about what they truly know. Now, in case you're curious, the Gardens Point campus is covered by 9,546 urban stone Jupiterana granite pavers. I know this not because I'm some sort of weird paving nerd, but because the company that provided the materials is part of the RBA's liaison program, through which we keep a close eye on real-world economic developments and is a key plank of our continuous learning process I'll elaborate on a bit later. Now, question two asks, will it rain in Brisbane tomorrow? Unlike the previous question, there's no certain answer, but we can put well-defined probabilities on it. History suggests, shown here, that it rains on just under 20% of August days, but we can do better than that because the Bureau of Meteorology uses much richer data and modelling to put the probability of rain tomorrow at a rather alarming 95%. Unlike most of us, weather forecasters are actually quite good at estimating their uncertainty about their short-term forecasts. Even as far back as the 1970s, if they told us there was a 95% chance of rain tomorrow, they were actually pretty close. The dots on this so-called reliability chart lie very close to that 45-degree axis. On the x-axis is the probability they forecast, and on the y-axis is the actual frequency of the probability of rain that they were forecasting, and that was many years ago. At first sight, question three, who will win the State of Origin Rugby League Series in 2025 seems pretty similar to question two. There's only two possible answers. There's actually three, somebody told me, because it was previously possible to draw, but that's no longer the case, I understand. But let's say there are only two possible answers now, and probabilities seem readily available from betting markets. But the similarities are actually pretty illusory. Today's short-term weather forecasts are a product of advanced stochastic modelling, yielding well-defined risk measures. But no model can fully capture the huge range of time-varying, ambiguous and judgmental factors that go into determining the winner of a sports series a year out. Such processes are said to be subject to so-called Knightian or radical uncertainty. Even as some of you will probably know, to your peril or otherwise, in the short gaps between this year's games, the quoted odds shown here in carefully chosen colours, by the way, bounce around like a yo-yo in response to a stream of unpredictable developments. Joseph, and I'm going to have a go at this, while Lee Ees being sent off in game one, Latrell Mitchell coming back triumphantly for New South Wales in game two, and the pitch battle of game three. Who knows on what as yet unimagined events next year's series will turn, but it seems likely that the current 60-40 odds quoted in favour, I'm afraid, of New South Wales reflect excessive confidence that whoever won this year will probably win next year too, rather than any more objective assessment, and that's a variant itself of the overconfidence bias. My final question was, what will Elon Musk do next? A more extreme form of radical uncertainty. Key drivers of that answer, his goals, his beliefs and motivations, are partly or wholly unobservable, so-called latent variables, and the range of possible answers is unbounded. Anyone claiming to have identified a small number of well-defined outcomes to that question, each with a clean probability, is at best being ambitious and at worst at risk of seriously overestimating their true confidence levels. Right, in what I hope is going to work, we're going to have a quick look at the results of your betting, or voting, I should say. There's no money at stake here, before we go on. So, Kate, let's see. Now, look, very interesting, well, to me anyway. This is the distribution of your answers. I couldn't work out how to get the confidence intervals working. But look, I would say that that distribution tells us fairly conclusively that I haven't got a clue is the right answer, even for those of you in this room who probably know that campus quite well. I will tell you the true answer. Well, you know the true answer is 9,546. I sneakily chose the range, by the way, because I thought actually more of you would pick the midpoint, which probably isn't a bad starting point, but you were obviously wise to that. So there you go. In terms of actually the distribution of your knowledge, not really knowing the answer is a good answer. I don't know who answered zero. That's a good one. question two. What's the percentage chance of rain in Brisbane tomorrow? Well, I hadn't banked on it being quite so gloomy and rainy today, so I guess a fair few of you were sort of saying, well, I know it's pretty wet today, and it's probably going to be wet tomorrow. So there's a slight bias, isn't there, to the right-hand side, and as I've said, 90 or 95% probability. You're probably, some of you are a bit closer to that, although, again, don't really know. It's probably not a bad guess. Question three. Now, I thought that this being a not entirely neutral room, that you all would have gone with 100%. But most of you, there's some clever guys here who realise we haven't really, maybe you were listening to what I was saying, haven't really got a clue and it's 50-50. But this is not a very loyal set of answers. We might have to pass this on to the authorities, this insufficient belief in the local team. Damn, never mind. And then final question, Elon Musk, which is a word cloud. Oh, my goodness me. I was a little bit worried that there might be some swearing in here, so probably have to move on quite quickly. But look, I mean, very dispersed, actually, right? I don't quite know how these word cloud algorithms work. But run for president seems to have got more than one award. Tweet and gone to Mars. I'm not sure what that means. I wish he'd go to Mars, or he's actually going to go to Mars. I don't know. But look, huge spread of answers. Anyway, look, that's the fun bit over. Thank you, Kate, very much indeed for that. We go back to the slides. But look, so what from all of that for monetary policy making? You might be thinking the ESA is about to ask for its money back, having asked me to come and talk about the economy. When we set interest rates, we have to look ahead. We have to make forecasts. That's one source of uncertainty. Monetary policy works with long and variable lags, so our forecasts have to be in the medium term, not the very short term like that overnight weather forecast. That's a second source of uncertainty. And most importantly of all, the things we're forecasting, inflation and unemployment, are the complex time-varying outcomes of the decisions and interactions of millions of people, companies and other organizations. And that puts us squarely in the world of Knightian uncertainty, the state of origin, or Elon Musk. But unfortunately, most of our models for economic analysis come from the worlds of paving stones and tomorrow's weather. Estimate the average historical relationship between individual economic variables, run those relationships forward in time, and you get a set of deterministic point forecasts. Those model-based forecasts can help tell us how the economy would respond if relationships remained exactly as they have been in the past. But if you over-rely on them, you have two key problems. Firstly, the probability of any given point forecast of being precisely correct is zero. That makes them a pretty poor basis for decision-making when you use them in isolation, because the absence of alternatives or fallbacks makes it harder to conceptualize other possible outcomes and weigh up the likelihood of those alternatives becoming reality. And that, in turn, can force forecasters either to underreact to news, forcing the data into their existing narrative rather than learning, or to overreact, jettisoning one point forecast for another demonstrably different path, which we already know is going to be wrong. Second, although it is possible to estimate confidence intervals around point forecasts using the models themselves, those intervals are likely to be substantially too narrow, exactly the same way as we were talking about those confidence intervals earlier, overconfident, because they fail to account for the fact that the model may just not be the right representation of reality. So just as overconfidence easily affects us in our everyday lives, it could easily affect monetary policymakers as well. How do we guard against that? Well, the starting point, to state the obvious, is to avoid placing too much reliance on point forecasts in the first place, and instead frame our policy decisions in terms of contingent hypotheses or judgments. Some judgments might be strongly held and hence given a high weight in the decision. Others may be quite tentative and given only a low weight. But both the hypotheses and the weights attached to them have to be continuously updated as we learn. To bring this to life, consider a key question in the run-up to the RBA's most recent policy decision. Why has CPI inflation been so unexpectedly persistent? A good place to start is to ask how unexpectedly persistent inflation has actually been, to learn from our own forecast errors. Those who treat such errors as failures, you will find this sort of exercise quite hard to do, but a more mature approach, and one long adopted by the RBA and other central banks, seeks instead to recognize that where forecasts are carefully constructed, as I hope they are, to make the best use of current data, misses contain vital information about that intrinsically complex and stochastic world. The idea is also embedded in the FANG charts shown around the RBA's outlook for inflation and other variables, which are calibrated using past forecast errors, not mechanical model outputs. Three key facts emerge when we look at the recent path of forecast errors for inflation. The first is that though underlying inflation shown here in the darker solid line for the June 2024 quarter was broadly in line with the RBA's main forecast, inflation in earlier periods in 2023 and 4 proved somewhat stickier than forecasts, which are those dotted lines. You can see the sort of mass of the dotted grey lines lies below the dark black outturn line. Secondly, the pattern for market expectations derived from inflation swaps shown here in yellow has been somewhat similar to our forecast, suggesting that it's not just the RBA that's been surprised on the upside by inflation, so have people paid lots of money to try and forecast the same thing and invest in it. Thirdly, some other jurisdictions have seen the reverse. So a rather greater incidence of inflation undershoots in recent quarters, raising the possibility that something slightly different might be underway in Australia. This graph, for example, tries to show the same picture as the one I showed for Australia and the RBA's forecast, but for the Eurozone. So there's the dark inflation outturns again in the dark line, and the forecast in the dotted grey lines. You can see the body of those dotted grey lines in the most recent period, not all of them, but the mass of them, it lies somewhat above inflation outturns rather than below. So to understand why past inflation outcomes may have been stronger than expected, you need a hypothesis. And in such circumstances, the economist's reflex is to reach for a model. Now, often some variant, as you know, of a Phillips curve in which higher inflation reflects a combination of higher expected inflation, higher demand, and lower supply. Now, if I take those three in turn, there's no evidence that longer-term inflation expectations rose over this period in Australia. And GDP came in at or below forecasts, which I'm going to tentatively assume is informative about demand conditions. So we therefore place some weight on the possibility that past upside inflation surprises reflected somewhat weaker supply than previously thought. Now, it's one thing to hypothesize weaker supply, it's another to quantify it, and that's because you can't actually go and see supply, just as you can't go and see Elon Musk's motivation. It's a classic latent variable. So any estimate is subject to huge uncertainty. In the most recent monetary policy round, RBA staff approached this challenge in two ways. The first is to use a range of alternative models to posit different assumptions about the structure of the economy to estimate that supply concept. It is common practice, as many, if not all of you know, to transform the results of those models into estimates of spare capacity in either the labor or the product markets. And this graph shows a range of spare capacity estimates for unemployment implied by that range of models. Choosing a single path within this range is subject to the exact same objections to point estimates that I just rehearsed, but to rationalize recent above-forecast inflation outcomes, the RBA's August statement on monetary policy assumes that supply in the past was probably somewhat weaker, and hence the labor market was probably somewhat tighter than we previously thought. And that extra weakness is expected to persist, pushing up a bit on the outlook for inflation. But it has to be said that the changes in assumption are tiny relative to the huge true range of uncertainty over these measures, which probably is, as I've repeatedly emphasized in this talk, underestimated even by that blue range. So we have to be humble about our confidence in that judgment. Spare capacity could easily be much higher or much lower than these models suggest. As a second cross-check, we also compared our estimates to qualitative real-world indicators of capacity pressures from company surveys and the RBA's liaison program. And by the way, I should say, Kate Davis, who's not there, because I think she's probably actually, unfortunately for her, having to operate my laptop, thank you, Kate, who leads our Brisbane office, is here today. If you don't already know her, try and say hello, because the work she and the team do truly fantastic, and I'm a big consumer of it. This graph shows that such measures lie at or above the upper end of our model-based estimates, the pink line and the black line. And that's also very consistent with the message of persistently elevated cost pressures that I have personally heard from my own liaison visits in the first few months of being here to Townsville, to Perth, to Adelaide, to Melbourne, to Western and Central Sydney, and even here this morning today in Brisbane. Future inflation, as we've already said, also depends on the outlook for demand. And here, too, we have to protect against the risk of overconfidence. In the latest statement on monetary policy, we do so in part by considering alternative scenarios, drawing on lessons from overseas, which are obviously particularly important for open economies like Australia, and the potential for changes in behavior. One scenario asks whether the unemployment rate may be about to pick up more rapidly than assumed, pulling down on demand and reducing inflationary pressure. In the central projection, the employment rate, which is shown here in yellow on the right-hand chart, only falls modestly in the projection period, with total hours worked in the economy, shown in the black line, rising as the population and participation in the labor market continue to grow. And that's consistent with past downturns in activity of similar magnitude, those two to the left, the early 2000s, and the global financial crisis. But those assumptions could be wrong. And in particular, the question we ask ourselves is, what if unemployment rises more rapidly, as it has in Canada, in Sweden, and New Zealand? And actually, even when we first drew this chart, the United States was very much in that pack of Australia and Germany, but that very latest point that we added on there after we first drew the chart, you know, it's not spectacularly high yet, but there in a nutshell is why the markets had a wobble a week ago. And this graph illustrates the results of that scenario, that, and it's not surprising perhaps, but that a higher unemployment path shown there in that pink ready line on the left will bring inflation back to the midpoint of the target range more rapidly on the right, more than offsetting that higher inflation persistence that I talked about earlier assumed in the central case. We also conducted a scenario exercise for household consumption. Now, judgments about consumption are really important for the inflation forecast because consumption accounts for about half of total Australian demand. Assuming that unemployment rises only gradually, as in the central case, our central projection for consumption growth is that it will pick up a bit in line with the expected recovery in household real incomes shown here in the black line in this chart. The drivers of that pickup in income, so you can see it on the chart yourself, are relatively clear, barring further shocks. But consumption also depends on the extent to which households choose to spend or save those higher incomes, and we're frankly much less confident in that judgment. It's possible, for instance, that households fortunate enough to have accumulated assets in recent years may choose to spend rather more than their past relationships suggest. Aggregate net wealth in the household sector, which I've shown here, has increased by a fairly impressive 58% in the past 5 years, much more than incomes, and that could pose upside risks to consumption. But at the same time, as many of you, all of you, will know well, other households, particularly the young, have been forced to cut their spending back sharply as real incomes have fallen, shown here in the light blue line. Higher future real incomes may relax some of those constraints, so some of those households may in fact increase their spending by more than historical relationships would suggest, because the extra dollar that they get is a very welcome addition to their spending. But it is also possible that persistent uncertainty about the future, which we've certainly seen in the past year or two, may cause them to rebuild savings or pay down debt, posing downside risks to the consumption forecast. Those two-sided uncertainties about future savings behavior are captured in two stylized profiles, and there's lots of lines going on here, but the essence of this is that on the left-hand side, one of those scenarios assumes that the saving ratio stays sort of close to its current relatively low level, that's the green line. The other assumes that it picks up to around its longer-term historical average, then that's the orange line. And as with other judgments, it's notable that really quite small differences in that assumption, those lines on the bottom left on the green saving ratio, you know, I mean, it's a decent-sized range, but those of you who are nerdy enough to follow these data in real time will know that some of these data were revised quite heavily, for example, in the last set of national accounts. The range between that orange line and the green line is not all that large when you compare it to the size of data revisions, and it's certainly not large at all when you compare it to the outputs of different models that you might use to model equilibrium savings ratio. So small changes in that assumption, well within those historical ranges, produce materially different outcomes for inflation and unemployment, some of which, as I said earlier, will be castigated as completely crazy and useless, and others of them will be declared to be a triumph. Well, actually, you know, all of these numbers can be generated by reasonable people with very small variations in assumption. Let me conclude. As humans, we're all prone to overconfidence, particularly when forecasting the future. In many cases, actually, as those charts from Menti really powerfully showed, the right answer that we should give is we just don't know. But it can be hard to say that, particularly if your job is to give a view, and particularly where, as I've shown, even small changes in judgment can have first-order effects on people's lives. Central bankers and those who comment on us are no exception to this universal human trait. And in my remarks today, I've tried to set out some of the ways in which we try to lean against overconfidence without falling into the opposite trap, which is just as dangerous, of saying nothing at all. By avoiding over-reliance on point estimates and instead framing our estimates in terms of contingent hypotheses, by continually adjusting the weights we place on those hypotheses through a process of learning from our own forecast errors, from a wide range of models, from qualitative data and intelligence from other countries, and through what-ifs and scenarios, and by communicating openly and honestly about where we are relatively confident about the outlook and where we're not, and where we're seeking to learn, and the balance of risks. Many of those tools are already in use at the Reserve Bank, and we'll move further in that direction as we complete the implementation of the RBA review. Now, of course, a billion-dollar question is how to map these essentially uncertain judgments into policy decisions, and that's really the subject for another speech. But the short answer is you need to choose strategies that are responsive to, robust to, your evaluation of the risks of the outlook just as much as they are to the central projection. In some cases, uncertainty may induce you to be less activist as you wait for more data or try to avoid triggering tail risks through your own actions. In others, it can induce you to be more activist. For example, the asymmetry of potential outcomes underpinning the policy response in many countries, including in Australia, during the COVID-19 pandemic. But beware anyone who claims it's obvious what to do, for they are false prophets. Thank you very much, and I look forward to the discussion with Michael.
Andrew, I can understand, having seen that presentation, on why the process of the RBA in making policy decisions is step by step. It's iterative. You really are reacting to the data as it happens, and it's presented to you every month. And and you really have to act directly. But anyway. I'll go firstly with Andrew. What we've decided is I'll ask two prepared questions, which he's had my two prepared questions for last hour.
You said you were going to say that. I thought I was going to look terribly clever again. Well, thank you for that question. Here's my 26-part answer to your question.
Yes, yes. Well, now we'll hear the 26-part answer to my first question. So I will ask two prepared questions, and then throw it open to the audience so that we can really get to the answers to the questions that you want to ask rather than I want to ask. Okay, Andrew, so the first question was, in your presentation of 27 June, you showed that historically Australia has been an importer of capital. And I remarked that two noted economists, Larry Summers and Olivier Blanchard of the Peterson Institute, have suggested that the high level of US net sovereign debt to GDP, which reaches 100% of GDP next year, according to the IMF estimates, will generate an equilibrium Fed funds rate, this is according to Larry and Olivier, an equilibrium Fed funds rate of not less than 4%, that is to say a real rate of around about 2%. So does this mean that the equilibrium real short rate in Australia is likely to move to a higher level going forward?
So I think this concept of equilibrium real exchange rate is a bit like the supply capacity number in my speech. It's a latent variable. You can't go and look for it anywhere, right? The Bank of England joined the first week he arrived, and he said, can somebody tell me where the measure of the equilibrium interest rate is? And some wit wrote back, we said, is it the same place as the Nairu, you know, and the sustainable level of output? You know, in other words, who knows? And so that's an important point to start with. Nobody knows the answer to that. Larry Summers is quite good at saying he does know the answer, although sometimes if you look back over his forecasting record, it's not quite... doesn't always follow quite the certainty of his predictions. So there's huge uncertainty about what this number is. When he says real rate of 2%, he's being provocative, right? Because if you look at the FOMC so-called dots, for example, at the estimate of FOMC members, that's U.S. monetary policy makers' estimates for the long-term real interest rate. They have a number like 0.5%. It's quite low.
Yes.
The John Williams estimate, John Williams, who's head of the New York Fed at the US, who's made a bit of a name at running various models on this, is probably somewhere between 0.5 and 1. So the 2 is a higher number, and that's your point, or his point, that he thinks it's going to be higher. There are an enormous number of different drivers of this number, right? I mean, ultimately, our star, as it were, sorry to use the phrase, our star equilibrium real rate is the outcome of equilibrium in the savings and investment market. And if you think about all the things that can drive that, those who think that number, including John and others, is relatively low, will put weight on things like, well, demographics, the countries are getting older, so they're having to dissave rather than save. They'll put weight on things like productivity, whereas, you know, in Australia and elsewhere, productivity rate growth rates in most Western countries, not the US actually, but most countries have been quite low. And we'll say, well, look, actually, I don't buy this number like 2%. It's a lot lower than that. There'll be others like Summers and others who say, well, look, you know, there's new shocks and new issues around. I mean, I think in talking about the US debt, he must be talking about a risk premium, if that's right, which is to say, look, there's so much debt that the US, and you know, 7% deficit of GDP is pretty impressive sometimes. They're issuing so much debt at some point, there'll be a wobble, there may even be concerns about default, risk premium will go up, and that R-star number will go up as people start charging up to lend to the US. And you could think of other reasons too. Many people who will think that the energy transition, for example, is going to lead to higher investment demand, which will raise that number. You know, who knows is the honest answer, whether it's 2%, 1%, or half. You asked a question about Australia, and because it's actually difficult to take no view on this at all, we have a swathe for our own equilibrium short rate, equilibrium rate, which is similar to that swathe of numbers that I showed you for unemployment. And actually, that has a central point of something like 3.5, 3.75 in nominal space. Obviously, our current cash rate is a little bit above that. So I think you pay your money and you take your choice. I wouldn't want to be someone actually trying to invest on the basis of these numbers. Summers may be right, but he may be wildly wrong.
Excellent. It's a terrible thing to confess in front of a public audience, but I really enjoy listening to that answer. Okay, so my...
we'll take a poll later if everyone agrees with that.
But yes, anyway, yes, well...
It's good to have an audience of one.
So the second question is Kevin Warsh. Kevin Warsh is a previous member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, and now he did that job for 5 years. Now he's a visiting distinguished fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford. In an article in the Wall Street Journal on the 28th of July, Kevin Warsh said that U.S. inflation and interest rates would be rising if the Fed was not reducing the size of its balance sheet. If it's reducing the size of its balance sheet, it's reducing the money base, and therefore that's what's driving inflation down. So, my question is, the RBA is currently running down its balance sheet, and it's quantitative tightening, and you can see this in the RBA chart book. So is this one of the reasons that the RBA has not been forced to increase interest rates?
So I could give you a one-word answer, which is no. You might not like that quite as much as you like my previous answer, so let me sort of elaborate a bit on that. The reason why people ask this question is that obviously when interest rates were at zero or the effective lower bound during the COVID period and beforehand in the UK, central banks had to find other ways of expanding, of easing policy. And as you know, they did it in the most part by buying assets and actually also by lending to banks at longer than normal maturities, both of which the RBA also did before I arrived here, but certainly the Bank of England did a great deal of this as well. And it was fairly commonly felt that that effectively added to the amount of monetary stimulus in the economy, that if you like, the effective short-term interest rate went negative to some extent, right? So the thought underpinning the Kevin argument, I guess, is that if it worked on the way in, why wouldn't it work on the way out? The trouble with that is that by and large, and people are looking at this very carefully, can't really find any material macroeconomic effect of unwinding the balance sheet at all. Maybe a few basis points here or there, but no major central bank that's doing it really considers that to be any part of its monetary policy strategy. We're all watching in case that view, learning, turns out to be wrong, but our central estimate is that it's likely that QE unwind, or so-called QT, quantitative tightening, actually a bad phrase, right, because the T implies more of an impact of the kind you're describing than is actually the case. But there's the central estimate at the moment across countries is that the multiplier of the QT effect is very, very small. Now, I have a particular personal engagement in this because the Bank of England was one of the very few central banks, in fact, I think the only one, that ran down its balance sheet not only by allowing assets to mature, but by actively selling them back to the market. The New Zealand RBNZ has been selling assets back to its own debt management agency, and the Riksbank, the Swedish central bank, has been doing active sales more recently. But when we first announced we had to do this, a reason we felt we had to do this is that the average maturity of the debt stock in the UK is very long, and we faced the prospect of having to hold gilts, government bonds, UK government bonds, more or less forever, unless we started actively selling, whereas for most countries, including Australia, the average maturity of bonds is far shorter. You can just let them roll off. We felt we had to do those active sales. I still think we had to do them. But the financial market threw its hands up in horror and said, this is a nightmare. You're going to bring the market, the world, to an end. You're going to drive interest rates up in exactly the way that Walsh is describing. That will cause mayhem in the financial markets. And I'm very pleased to say that prediction was another overconfident prediction of mayhem that turned out to be completely wrong. There is very little evidence so far that balance sheet unwind has driven market interest rates up materially, though we must continue to watch. So, no, it's not one of the reasons why the RBA has not had to lift rates. There's one other reason before I finish, which is that actually the big unwind in the balance sheet of the RBA that's happened over the past 6 or 12 months has not been primarily allowing bonds to unwind, but as you probably know, it's the maturity of the so-called TFF, the Term Funding Facility, which is a lending facility to banks. Again, I think there was a considerable concern here, it was largely before I arrived, that unwind might cause difficulties. It's a very sharp reduction in the stock of money in Australia, but it has gone by practically without a whimper. So far, so good. At some point, if you keep reducing your balance sheet, the stock of reserves will hit the demand for reserves. And if you hit that at too sort of sharp an angle, you may find that these relatively calm financial conditions turn into considerable instability again. And a lot of central banks are watching for that moment, but it hasn't come yet.
Now, hopefully there are two roving microphones in the audience, which are being held by two members of the Young Economist. So if we have any questions in the audience, please put up your hand and a microphone will come to you so that you can ask the question. Here there is a... We have a microphone here, please.
Thanks very much for that window into how the bank makes its decisions. I've got one on that theme. When assessing its base rate decision-making and reflecting on the inflationary environment, in relative terms, is the bank currently looking for greater easing of indicators in private or public sector activity, and which of those indicators currently carries the greatest weight?
Are you drawing particular focus on the public versus private, or...? Most prices is maybe an overstatement. The prices that demand factors affect are predominantly set in the private sector. I mean, you know that. And therefore, many of the tools that we've used, I've described today, the Phillips curve and the output gaps and all of those things, are really describing a pricing process, which is a pricing process that is followed by private companies. So I think the easy and straightforward answer is to say that we expect that most of the change in inflation is going to come through those private sector pricing decisions. There's been an interesting debate about whether so-called administered prices or prices that are either partly or wholly affected by public or institutional rules of some kind. And I guess that it's quite hard actually to pin down exactly what that means. Is it purely the price of a public good, or is it the price of a private good that's affected by private rules, et cetera, et cetera? There's been some interesting discussions about whether people think those are components, and maybe this is the point of your question, are sort of holding inflation up. Those elements are relatively high as part of the basket, but they're always relatively high. What is different about the current environment, and we looked at this quite carefully in the last statement on monetary policy, is that private sector prices, or inflation rather, are somewhat elevated to their normal levels. So that's felt like a slightly rambling answer to your question, but I think it's certainly the case that the majority of our analytical tools have greatest purchase on private sector price setting.
We have another question over there.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Deputy Governor. Ken Howard from Morgans. Just interested in any reflections you might have on the intergenerational wealth transfer that's obviously going to flow in the next decade or so, as well as all that superannuation money as baby boomers and others reach their retirement. How's that going to drive inflation, consumption, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting question. I've had to spend, as a veteran of the LDI crisis, some of you, maybe you in the room will know what I mean by that, maybe not everyone does, at the back end of 2022, a fairly dramatic budget by the newly appointed Prime Minister Liz Truss in the UK at the time sent the UK gilt market into a tailspin, and that caused the pension industry in the UK, which is different from the superannuation industry here. As you know, it's based predominantly on defined benefit schemes and much more mature in terms of the average age of those pension funds, sent them into a tailspin, and we had to intervene, the Bank of England, in large size to prevent a small wobble becoming a major crisis. So one of the earliest things that people said to me here, actually, when I was coming to Australia, was get your head around the super fund industry. They're big. They're getting bigger. It's a very important positive part of the Australian policy environment, but one that you will need to understand. Now, as you say, I think implicit in your question, you know, the average age of the member of a super fund at the moment is relatively young, and that has influenced the portfolio composition of super funds, which is predominantly in equities and notoriously quite heavily in terms of the marginal dollar is invested overseas as well. How that will affect inflation in the future sounds like a harder question than the one you've asked me, and I'm sort of playing for time in the hope that my brain will snap into gear. The R-star argument is interesting there, coming back to the earlier point. You know, is Australia's R-star different to the global R-star? Now, I think probably most models would tell you that it shouldn't be, because the market for global capital is global. And if we seek to set interest rates, real interest rates, at a materially different level from global rates, that will probably end in tears and won't be possible. But I'm going to mark myself gamma minus on that. Yeah, why don't you have a go while I'm thinking? Ah, you look at your watch. No, you can't do that. You didn't let me do that.
Yes. Oh, well, my view is that...
He's the same firm as you.
Yeah, yeah.
You told him to ask that question.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of confusion in people trying to measure it against the stock of debt, whereas to me, what I find has a lot of explanatory power is the size of the budget deficit. So as budget deficits increase, then the real yield on bonds increases. And so what I find this to be true. I've measured this. I think as what we've got is these continuing US budget deficits because of increasing debt to GDP. So you're going to have to sell more and more bonds, and the more and more bonds you sell into the market, the real price of those bonds goes down. That's what I think.
If you think that an aging society drives R-star down, and we just discussed a bunch of reasons that suggest, well, maybe it will drive R-star down, but other things will drive it up. But if you think it will drive it down, then we are going to go back to a period of relatively low interest rates. Now, obviously, as we discovered during COVID and before, having sort of, you know, equilibrium rates near zero is a bit of a pain in the neck, because it means you have to use things other than interest rates in order to control inflation. And if you fail to do that sufficiently effectively, you're going to get, you know, deflation, which, of course, is painful in lots of ways. I think predicting that aging societies will lead to deflation because central banks don't do their job effectively is probably, you know, building a set of stories up to Armageddon that's probably a bit overstated, if I'm honest. But if I need to give you a better answer to your question, and I apologise for not doing very well on that. There you go.
Well, in that case, I look forward to your return at a future time because
right, very good.
Really, tragically, what I'm told by this terrible document here is that the time for questions has run out. I've enjoyed them enormously, I have to tell you. And let's give our speaker a round of applause.